Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LPFM 106.1, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, November 26, 2005. Our focus today is on issues of U.S. imperialism and Iraq. Here's what we have coming up. Our first hour begins with a recent talk given by Noam Chomsky on U.S. imperialism. We'll then hear from Aaron Glanz, author of How America Lost Iraq, and his report on three trips he took to Iraq recently. Our second hour will feature People's History, Music, Between the Lines, Independent Radio from Connecticut, and more. First, we bring you some news. From the Seattle Post-Intelligencer on November 25th. Sheehan back in Texas for war protest. The mother of a fallen soldier who led a vigil against the war in Iraq outside President Bush's ranch returned to Texas, saying she is heartbroken that the troops are not home. When Cindy Sheehan arrived at the Waco airport on Thursday, three dozen supporters erupted into cheers and tears and grabbed her for lengthy embraces. Before they whisked her back to Crawford, the group chanted, "Stop the war, bring them home now." Sheehan said, "We will keep pressing and we won't give up until our troops are brought home." Sheehan asked protesters to return to Crawford this week during Bush's family Thanksgiving gathering. She was unknown when she set up camp outside Bush's ranch during his August vacation, but as the vigil drew thousands, she attracted national attention. Before Sheehan's arrival, more than 100 protesters at the camp ate a traditional Iraqi meal for Thanksgiving, saying they wanted to call attention to the innocent Iraqi victims, in addition to the more than 2,100 U.S. soldiers killed since the war began in March 2003. From the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, by Dawd Salman, IWPR trainee journalist in Baghdad, on November 23rd. Sunnis complain of random arrests and torture. The recent revelations of torture at a secret Baghdad jail did not surprise many of the capital's Sunni Arab residents and leaders, who said civil rights violations have become a regular occurrence. Sunni Arabs here said that months before reports of torture at the Ministry of Interior facility emerged, the ministry and the Iraqi National Guard were randomly arresting, torturing, and killing members of their community. They also accuse security forces of allowing armed militias to roam freely in the city. "Citizens do not know what fate awaits them at night," said Maeen Hamid, a 21-year-old university student in Baghdad. "They don't know if they will be arrested, killed, and their bodies mutilated. The random arrests have made life here an eternal nightmare." The U.S. military last week raided a makeshift jail in a former bomb shelter of an Interior Ministry building in the Jadariya neighborhood. About 170 detainees, most of them Sunni Arabs, were held at the facility, and several of them reported being tortured. There were reports that they had suffered beatings and electric shocks, and there were photos of detainees with their skin ripped off and holes drilled into their bodies. Three major Sunni parties, the Iraqi Islamic Party, the National Accord Front, and the National Dialogue Conference, called for the resignation of Interior Minister Jabir. Jabir said the torture was not widespread, but agreed to allow a U.S.-led inspection of Iraq's 1,100 jails and prisons. Tariq al-Hashimi, Secretary General of the Iraqi Islamic Party, said the party gave the Prime Minister and Interior Ministry 50 documents and detailed notes regarding random arrests and torture of Sunni Arabs. Hashimi also said the party has photographic evidence of human rights violations, including killings as a result of torture, but has not received a response from the government. Faik Amin Bakir, Director of Forensic Medicine at the Health Ministry, said, "The bodies we receive from the Ministry of Interior are severely mutilated and damaged." He maintained that torture and killing were on the rise in prisons. A source at the Human Rights Ministry said it had found similar evidence of torture. The allegations are not new. U.S.-based Human Rights Watch issued a detailed report in January accusing security forces of random arrests and of torturing prisoners. The Ministry of Human Rights has recorded torture cases and the killing of detainees in the Baqa prison in the Umm Qasr area in Basra province and in Abu Ghraib prison. Security forces continue to conduct random arrests despite calls by Iraqi president and the prime minister to obtain court warrants, say community leaders. From the Boston Globe on November 19th, Patriot Act extension shelved, privacy concerns delay legislation. Capping another tough week for President Bush and top Republicans in Congress, a bipartisan backlash forced congressional leaders to shelve a bill to extend provisions of the USA Patriot Act that expire at the end of the year. Sidetracking the White House's push to preserve the expanded police powers authorized after the 2001 terrorist attacks, a rare coalition of liberal Democrats and conservative Republican lawmakers are demanding that the bill's more controversial provisions, set to run out at the end of December, should include more civil liberties safeguards. They want federal authorities to notify targets of secret sneak-and-peek searches within 7 days of executing the warrant, get a judge's approval before searching medical, financial, and library records, and allow the subjects of an investigation to challenge court gag orders issued against them. Senator John E. Sununu, Republican of New Hampshire, said, "We can protect civil liberties and still fight the war on terrorism." He joined a group of senators threatening to filibuster the measure as crafted by the Bush administration and House leaders. "We think we can work out bipartisan compromise, a reasonable compromise." The biggest sticking point is the new expiration date of the provisions that will run out in December. The White House and some GOP leaders in Congress want the renewed provisions kept intact for at least 7 years, but a solid block of lawmakers want them reviewed sooner. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Arlen Specter, whose panel has jurisdiction over the matter, said, "There ought to be a 4-year sunset so we can review it again in a reasonably timely fashion." Representative Dana Rohrabacher, Republican of California, said, "I didn't come to Washington, D.C. to expand the police powers of the federal government. To make these temporary expansions of police power permanent as our way of life, changing our way of life in America, altering the balance of liberty and police powers, is outrageous." And last, from the BBC, on November 23rd, Venezuela gives U.S. cheap oil deal. Officials from Venezuela and Massachusetts have signed a deal to provide cheap heating oil to low-income homes in the state. The fuel will be sold at about 40% below market prices to thousands of homes over the winter months. Local Congressman William Delahunt described the deal as an expression of humanitarianism at its very best. Venezuela's president, Hugo Chavez, is one of the Bush administration's biggest adversaries in Latin America. The deal involves shipping some 45 million liters of heating oil from Venezuela to Massachusetts at a discounted rate via Citgo Petroleum, a U.S.-based subsidiary of the Venezuelan state-owned oil company. At a signing ceremony in Massachusetts, Mr. Delahunt, a Democrat who helped broker the deal, rejected suggestions that it was politically motivated. "This is a gesture about people," the Associated Press quotes him as saying. Talks are underway for a similar deal to provide discounted heating oil from Venezuela to low-income residents in New York's Bronx District. Que viva
Chango, que viva Chango, que viva Chango, que viva Chango, señores.
And now for Noam Chomsky on U.S. imperialism.
Good afternoon, I'm Joe Broadhurst, and you're listening to a CKET special presentation. Joining us from Boston on the phone is Professor Noam Chomsky. Good afternoon, Mr. Chomsky.
Hi, glad to be with you.
Many seem to claim that after fumbling the ball initially, the media is now, mainstream media, doing a better job on Iraq coverage. Could you comment on that?
Well, frankly, I think the job is just shockingly embarrassing. That's not the U.S. media. It's all the Western media, as far as I know. I mean, suppose we were in Nazi Germany, let's say, in 1943. Would the only question be, how can we make sure that our efforts are a success? Is there a better strategy? Did we make a mistake by starting a two-front war, and maybe we should do something else to try to make it work better? And was that the only question that could be asked? Listen, I mean, just driving in this morning, I happened to be listening to National Public Radio. It's supposed to be the liberal media. And I happened to be listening to discussion of this. That's the only question. What went wrong? How can we make sure we succeed? Can we do it better? Were we misled into getting into the war? I mean, there's another question, after all. Same question that was raised at the Nuremberg trials. What right do you have to invade another country? Now, why were people hanged at Nuremberg? Because they committed what the Nuremberg tribunals called the supreme international crime, which encompasses within it all the evil that follows, namely the act of aggression, attacking another country. In fact, the German foreign minister, von Ribbentrop, one of the main charges against him was that he participated in a preemptive war, the invasion of Norway, on the grounds that it posed a threat to Germany, as in fact it did, but that was considered enough grounds for hanging him. The American justice at the chief counsel, American chief counsel at Nuremberg, Robert Jackson, at the end of the tribunal, when these, notice that the people charged at Nuremberg were not low-level soldiers who tortured somebody or pushed someone into a gas chamber or something. They weren't tried at Nuremberg. The ones who were tried were the leadership, top leadership. I mean, if they never pushed anyone into a gas chamber, they're the ones who were charged. And Jackson gave an eloquent oration in which he said that these crimes, he said we should recognize that we are creating what he called a poison chalice. We may have to drink from it. If we commit the same crimes, we should be subjected to the same judgment. Otherwise, the trial of Nuremberg is not justice, but just punishment by the victors. Well, okay. Eloquent words. Anybody lived up to it ever since? Let's go back to Iraq. Can you think of a more open and flagrant case of plain, outright aggression? Does that question even arise? No, the only question that arises is, well, you know, how can we make the best success of it? And that's typical. You know, the same was true of the Vietnam War, outright aggression. The same was true of the U.S. terrorist war in Nicaragua, which in fact falls almost explicitly under the definition of aggression given by Justice Jackson at Nuremberg, although maybe you could just call it international terrorism if you want to be kind to the Reagan administration. Did these questions ever arise? Would the media ever even consider them? Not just the media, the journals of opinion, in fact, the scholarship. No. We just do not apply to ourselves the standards we insist upon for others, which is just, you know, that's the lowest level of moral depravity. I mean, the most elementary moral principle you can imagine is that you apply at least the same, you apply the same standards to yourself that you do to others. Actually, stricter standards, if you want to be serious, but at least the same standards. I mean, that's almost unthinkable in Western discourse, not just the media. And from then on, it just deteriorates. Everything follows from the total incapacity even to think the thought that we ought to be subject to the standards we impose on others. Anyone who proposes that is, considered a madman or a kind of lunatic, a conspiracy theorist or whatever, supporter of Osama bin Laden or whatever the latest insult is.
An individual scandal that seems to be addressing the issue of why America went to war, and Judith Miller, I'm speaking of that. And we notice that the media focuses a lot on individuals and their scandals. Can any change be hoped for by looking at Libby and Rove and identifying the bad eggs?
Well, there are no bad eggs. I mean, it's kind of a striking fact about the... First of all, Judith Miller, I mean, her reports were awful, and it was obvious at the time. But wasn't it obvious to New York Times editors? I mean, they were saying pretty much the same things in their editorials. You take a look at their editorials, pretty much the same, you know. Got to do something. The next thing we'll hear from Iraq will be a mushroom cloud, and so on and so forth. And that's across the board, not just the New York Times. I'll read the Canadian press that carefully, but I'll bet it's the same. Nuances of difference. I mean, there's a very striking fact about the political situation in the United States now. I mean, so striking that many mainstream political commentators have pointed it out. The Bush administration and the Republican Party are in pretty serious straits. There's a lot of popular disaffection with them. They don't like what they're doing. You know, they've gotten themselves into all kinds of domestic and international disasters. But the Democrats aren't gaining anything from it. The only thing that they're gaining is decline in the popularity of the Bush administration. Why aren't they presenting some alternative? Well, you know, there's a reason. They really don't have any alternative to present. They mostly went along with all of this. What are they going to say?
Well, there's an alternative path, perhaps, that I've read about in the work of Gary Hart, Senator Gary Hart, who says in a recent book of his, I think it's called The Fourth Power, that America should consolidate itself as a republic, the republic that it once was. And he softly criticizes the imperial aspirations of America. Is that an alternative?
Yeah, that's what most of the population wants. But if you take a look at, I mean, public opinion in the United States is studied with great intensity. And if you look at public opinion, yes, it turns out that both political parties are very far to the right of the general population on a whole host of issues, including this one. I mean, the large majority of the public takes a pretty conservative view of the UN Charter, which rules out very explicitly any kind of preventive war, preemptive war. That's the major war crime. And the public says the same thing. Large majority of the public says that the use of force should not be permitted except under attack or imminent threat of attack, which, of course, didn't arise at this point. Why did the public, at least the majority of it, support the war? Well, you know, because there was a government media propaganda campaign beginning in September 2002 that really frightened people. Yeah, Saddam Hussein's coming to get us. You know, we got to cower in fear. The New York Times and everyone else was part of it. So yes, people were afraid. Our lives are in danger. We got to protect ourselves. Well, you know, we don't have to talk about that anymore. But the public was driven into war, and that's true on this case, and it's true on a whole range of other cases. So it's a very simple, quite conservative proposal as to how to create an alternative in the United States. Namely, pay some attention to the attitudes of the public, the public opinion. There's an enormous gap between public opinion and public policy. Well, an alternative is to let public opinion have some influence, maybe a significant influence on policy. Or to put it simpler, more simply, an alternative is to move towards becoming a functioning democracy instead of a system with formal democratic forms, but very little substance. The public just isn't part of it and knows it, incidentally. It's one of the reasons for the disaffection. So sure, there are alternatives, but the political leadership, the media, corporate system are not going to push them. They don't want the public opinion to have a role in policy. And there's a good reason when you look at what public opinion is. So if, take, for example, just take one example. Every roughly roughly February, the administration comes out with a budget. So last February, the second Bush administration came out with its federal budget. Well, immediately after the budget came out, there was a serious study by the major polling institution in the country of people's attitudes toward the budget. Turns out that they're virtually a mirror image of the budget, where the budget was going to go up, population wanted it to go down, and this is large majorities, incidentally. So military spending, supplementals for Iraq and Afghanistan, that sort of thing. Budget going way up, public wants to go way down. Where the budget is going down, public wants it to go up, again by large majorities. Social spending, education, renewable energy, huge majorities, support for the United Nations, enormous majorities, and so on. When you get to taxes, a very large majority of the public wants to rescind Bush's tax cuts for the rich. That is for people with incomes over $200,000, which is the major tax cuts. That's an overwhelming majority. Congressional plans are to cut it further. I mean, in fact, it's almost a caricature. The opinions and budget are virtually a mirror image. Well, in a democratic society, there's nothing more important than for people to know what, you know, their neighbors think. How can you have a functioning democratic society if each person thinks I must be a lunatic because what they tell me in the press is everybody thinks something else? You know how much coverage this had? Zero. There was a big search by some people who do databases who couldn't find one report, even in a small newspaper, of people's attitudes toward the budget. Well, that's pretty typical. And it indicates, doesn't suggest, a very serious erosion of functioning democracy, which does suggest a very definite and extremely conservative alternative. Let's reconstruct a more democratic society. Nothing about democracy promotion in Iraq, which is a joke. How about democracy promotion right here?
What seems to be the most glaring repudiations of international law and indeed even domestic moral sensibilities enacted by the Bush administration, which is the installation of torture into the fabric of American military and intelligence operations. This is exemplified, of course, in recent revelations of secret CIA interrogation facilities in Eastern Europe, but also the legislated attempts to exempt CIA operations from John McCain's anti-torture amendment to the Defense Appropriations Bill. I just was wondering if you could comment about the functions you think this commitment to torture serve very specifically in the modern context and the modern political landscape.
Well, you're quite right. It is very shocking. I mean, so shocking that it has scandalized constitutional lawyers, you know, conservative historians of the justice system and so on. You take a look at the Journals of International Law and so on, they're just utterly outraged. The Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which is about as respectable as you can get, had an article by a very distinguished academic specialist and lawyer on constitutional lawyer, in which he said, literally, he said that the eminence grise of the Bush administration, he said, is Carl Schmitt, that was Hitler's legal counselor. And then he went on to say that the concept of presidential authority being crafted by the Justice Department is following Carl Schmitt's concept of what the Führer is allowed to do. You know, you don't find words like that in super respectable conservative journals very often. And there's very detailed discussions in the law journals. Yeah, it's outrageous. Gonzalez, who is considered too liberal to be appointed to the Supreme Court, he was the president's legal counsel. And he advised, he gave some very interesting advice to the president in a memorandum of 2002. First of all, he said that we should put aside the Geneva Conventions, which are the foundations of modern international humanitarian law, because he said their provisions are, his words were, quaint and obsolete. Okay, so we get rid of that. And then he urged Bush, advised Bush as his legal counsel, to formally rescind the Geneva Conventions, elements of them, because he said that would reduce the probability of prosecution under international law. In other words, you're going to be carrying out major violations of fundamental international law, so you therefore better rescind the law. And in fact, that makes good sense, because there's, quite apart from international law, there was a War Crimes Act passed by Congress, Republican Congress, incidentally, in, I think it was 1996, which makes what are called grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions a war crime that is punishable by death. Okay, yeah, better rescind it or else you're going to be in trouble, even under domestic law. Yes, that's happening, and it's an utter scandal. I mean, how it ranks in comparison with blatant acts of aggression and, you know, virtual destruction of another country, I don't know how it ranks with that. You can't make that measure, but it's very serious. The Bush administration is quite openly turning the United States into what's called in the literature an outlaw state, a state that has utter and total contempt for international law and opinion of others and so on. We call that an outlaw state. I mean, it's not that they're breaking entirely new ground on this. Remember that the United States is now the only country in the world that has rejected a World Court judgment. It used to have company. Hoxha's Albania had not done so, but now Albania moved toward the civilized world and accepted the judgment, which leaves the U.S. in splendid isolation, and not on a trivial matter. It's on a matter of international terrorism. The court ordered the Reagan administration, 1986, to terminate its terrorist war against Nicaragua and pay substantial reparations. The U.S. disregarded it, bipartisan rejection, incidentally, media as well. The New York Times simply dismissed the court as what it called a hostile forum, because it ruled against the United States, so therefore we can disregard it. Nicaragua then brought the case to the Security Council, where the U.S. vetoed two resolutions endorsing the court judgment. Britain politely abstained. I mean, that's unique, and it's not a marginal issue. I mean, the U.S., in fact, escalated the war and went on virtually to destroy the country. That's a pretty serious fact. I mean, not the kind of fact you're going to read about in the media or journals or history books and so on, but a fact. Yes, so it's not that and there are many other cases. The Bush administration, however, is breaking totally new ground. And torture is horrible enough. Invasion is horrible enough. But in some ways, there's even more serious cases. So, I mean, the fate of the species, it's not an exaggeration to say that the fate of the human species is in danger, real danger. There are two major dangers. One of them is nuclear war, which would be probably the end. And it's, you know, can't give a number, but it's the danger is increasing. I mean, again, you can read in the most respectable conservative journals, leading strategic analysts pointing out that Rumsfeld's transformation of the military carries, I'm quoting, an appreciable risk of ultimate doom. And the doom is not always considered so ultimate. Robert McNamara had an article in one of the leading foreign policy journals called Apocalypse Soon, because of the same policies. One of the few barriers to that was the Non-Proliferation Treaty. It has a regular 5-year review. The last one was in May. It ended up in a total disaster. The media version is because Iran wouldn't agree to tighten up the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But the real reason, if you look, and I think the Canadian Foreign Minister may have pointed it out, is that the U.S. was simply refusing to live up to its obligations under the treaty, in fact, quite openly. In fact, it said, in effect, we're bound by the treaty. Okay, that's could be the death knell of the species. It's also dismantled the whole array of international treaties that were part of the NPT bargain. That's one side. Then comes environmental destruction. You know, it's not as fast and total as nuclear war, but it's very serious. You can't pretend it's not there unless you happen to be in the White House. There was the meetings in the G8 meetings, you know, the eight industrial countries in Scotland last July. Right before the meeting, the National Academies of Science of all eight countries, that includes the U.S. National Academy, joined by China, India, Brazil, and others, issued a strong plea to the G8 leaders to take urgent action to deal with an impending catastrophe. Well, they couldn't. Didn't get much reported here. I don't know about Canada, but in the British Financial Times, you know, the world's major business journal, they described it very straight out. They said, look, we're facing a really serious global problem. There's got to be something done about it, but there's one difficulty. The White House says it doesn't believe the scientific evidence. I mean, they just ridiculed it, but that's a fact. And therefore, they said that the conclusions of the G8 meeting were just meaningless words. You know, that's pretty serious. And again, it's over the overwhelming objection of the American population. The population very strongly supports the Kyoto Protocols. Neither of the political parties does, but the population does. In fact, supports it so strongly that a majority of Bush voters, think that he supported it because they regard it as so obvious. Well, you know, there's major catastrophes lying ahead, and they're being made worse. The threat is being made worse. Same incidentally with the threat of terror. Now, that's a very low priority for the administration. I mean, there's example after example of that, and I suppose the most striking example is the invasion of Iraq. Now, that was undertaken with the anticipation that it would very probably increase the threat of terror. So that's just not important to the Bush administration or the political opposition which supported the war. And in fact, that's just what happened. Reports of the CIA, other intelligence agencies, Israeli intelligence, go across the board, German intelligence, have pointed out what you can see on the newspapers. Yeah, it's increased the threat of terror. That's just not just a couple of days ago in Jordan. Yes. That's increasing the threat to the United States and England and others. That was understood. It has now happened. But it just indicates that it's just they don't care that much. I mean, if the U.S. intelligence community gives a subjective estimate of the probability of nuclear terror in the United States in the next decade, their estimate is about 50%. I mean, this means a dirty bomb, not a bomb that's going to destroy the country. But the effects of that would be just incalculable. I mean, quite apart from the immediate effects of the catastrophe. And how serious that will be, I mean, bad enough in itself, even if there were some preparations. But there are no preparations. I mean, that was what we saw at Hurricane Katrina. I mean, there is there's Homeland Security, there's FEMA, all of them. They weren't ready. And the reason is because the Bush administration has simply downgraded them. FEMA, which is supposed to be responsible for dealing with catastrophes, was folded into another government organization, downgraded. A lot of its leadership, most expert people have just left in disgust. And when Katrina came along, they just weren't ready to do anything for it. Imagine what will happen with a nuclear dirty bomb going off in New York.
From Circle A Radio, free speech radio news reporter Aaron Glantz speaks to us about his time in Iraq as an unembedded reporter. He has a new book about the experience, How America Lost Iraq. This is an edited version of this talk.
For many Iraqis, the moment of support for the resistance came in April, when the U.S. military invaded Fallujah, a Sunni city of 200,000 on the banks of the Euphrates River, west of Baghdad. For 25 days, the United States Marine Corps bombarded the city, killing at least 600 civilians, wounding thousands, and turning tens of thousands of Fallujans into refugees in their own country.
Ahmed was in my class. He was younger than me. He was standing next to the wall of the secondary school. He was trying to cross the road and he was hit by a bullet. The American troops fired the bullet. Americans shoot us on the street. They even bombed our school. We are innocent kids. We can't play on the streets because of the Americans.
Aaron Glantz began working at KPFA, Pacifica Radio's Berkeley station, when he was 19.
Everything that I know about being a journalist, I learned, you know, in community radio. And I learned it from the news directors at KPFA, you know, who trained me, and from my peers. First, my peers, the other volunteer reporters at KPFA and the staff reporter there, and then from other reporters that I met through producing Free Speech Radio News. And I was able to produce the national news, and got to meet all these cool reporters because we organized it as a collective. So I was always talking to people in like India and France and the Middle East and South America, and I was like, oh, these people are really cool. I can do what they're doing. I don't need to like be just like here in Northern California. I can go to the ground in these situations. I can see the world and get paid for it. So that's what I did.
Aaron Glantz covered the Middle East for Pacifica during the American invasion of Iraq, and started reporting from Iraq when Saddam Hussein's regime fell. He's been to Iraq 3 times and has just released a book, How America Lost Iraq, about his experiences. Circle A Radio interviewed Aaron Glantz about his experiences on the ground as a war reporter. We began by asking about the first time he entered Iraq.
I went door to door, you know, in Karada, which is a middle class, ethnically diverse neighborhood of downtown Baghdad. And I walked through this building. I mean, it had no electricity because the whole city had no electricity at that time. And still to this day, there's only about 3 hours of electricity in Baghdad every day. We use a cigarette lighter to light our way up the stairs. And when we got to the top of the stairs, the first family that led us into their apartment told us that they planned to name their next child after George Bush, even though they had no electricity, no running water. And we're currently out of work because of the security situation still. And people said this because they believed that their current situation would be temporary. And I think as it's proved that that's not temporary, people are increasingly are moving towards other kinds of tactics. I got to Iraq on like April 28th or 29th, 2003. On May 1st, 2003, which is the day that George Bush landed on the USS Abraham Lincoln off the coast of San Diego and declared mission accomplished. On that day, I was in Fallujah, unembedded. And Fallujah was the place to be because on the day that I arrived in Baghdad, the Americans had killed the first civilians of the occupation. There had been a demonstration against the U.S. military taking over a school and turning it into a military base in Fallujah. The people of Fallujah protested this, and the American soldiers in Fallujah fired into the crowd, killing 12 people. Then, when the funerals happened a few days later, there was also a demonstration. The American soldiers again fired into that crowd and killed more innocent civilians, and no American soldiers were hurt in either of these incidents. So when I went to Fallujah on May 1st, 2003, to try to figure out what was going on. I expected there to be a very large demonstration because that was a Friday. And I expected the preachers in Fallujah to tell the people to go out to protest, and there would be a gigantic protest, and there would be a huge confrontation that might end in blood. And so I thought it was important to be there. But instead, you know, after I walked through the vegetable market and the chicken market and the gun market, the preacher in Fallujah, the most pro-Saddam preacher, was telling people not to protest, that Islam is a religion of peace, and he had been negotiating with the Americans, and he told them that. So there was no violence. That was the situation at that time. I think people here, you know, they were watching the images on Fox and the very jingoistic coverage that we were getting in the mainstream media here, and they were looking for something to specifically counter that. To say, okay, Fox is telling you one thing, well, the truth is the exact opposite of that. But that, in fact, was not exactly the case, and I was finding that the big important stories of that time were not the human rights abuses of the Americans, because, in fact, during the bombing campaign, the U.S. military had actually done a reasonably good job of only bombing quote-unquote regime targets, as Donald Rumsfeld had said, although, you know, there were a lot of innocent civilians killed as well, but that they were targeting, you know, ministries, military bases, and the Iraqi army. So I found that the big story was like the 20,000 bodies that were being pulled out of the ground in Babylon that had been killed by Saddam Hussein after George Bush Sr. told the Iraqi people to rise up and then allowed Saddam Hussein to slaughter them in 1991. The full accounting of all of his atrocities and the reuniting of Iraqi people with at least the bodies of their loved ones who had been killed.
A few days after George Bush declared the U.S. military had succeeded in toppling Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, an American military Caterpillar vehicle fills the newly excavated mass grave next to a wheat field just outside the Iraqi town of Hilla, an hour and a half's drive south of Baghdad. For almost a month after Saddam put down a Shiite rebellion in 1991, busloads of prisoners were taken to this field three times a day. Tens of thousands of skeletons have been pulled from the ground, many of them bound and blindfolded. Now, with Saddam Hussein removed from power, Shiites are coming from all over Iraq, sifting through the dried bones, hoping to find their loved ones. Thousands of bodies have been claimed, but not everyone was able to find their family. This man was looking for his son Laith and his wife's brother Haider Ibrahim. He had nothing but kind words for America's current president. Like many Iraqis, he directs his anger towards George Bush Sr. At the end of the 1991 Gulf War, the elder Bush called on the Iraqi people to rise up and promised American support for their revolution. But when the people of Iraq rebelled, the American president withdrew his support and allowed Saddam to engage in a mass slaughter of the Shiites of southern Iraq.
The first Bush is the reason of this mass grave and what happened for all Iraqi people from 1991 until now. Because if they finished Saddam in 1991, nothing would have happened and we would have been safe.
But a year later, Shanam Abu Jaber, like most Iraqi people, has changed his mind about the occupation of his country. Many of his relatives have joined the resistance. Some have been arrested and are being held at the now notorious Abu Ghraib prison.
It's the same struggle as under Saddam's regime. Now it's been rebuilt by the Americans themselves.
He says a year after the beginning of the American occupation, the U.S. military has proven to be a harsh military overlord. He's also upset at the lack of electricity, employment, and clean water, all of which were in greater supply under Saddam's regime.
The military mind of the Americans didn't know how to deal with the resistance. They didn't know how to control them or to make them on their side, because it's not just a matter to have a gun and fight. It's a matter of our thoughts. We will join the resistance by our thoughts for all the people who are unable to fight. The women, the children, and young men didn't want to fight, but they are against the Americans because of the way the Americans behave toward the resistance, how they go against the resistance.
People were already complaining. They were saying thank you to the Americans for getting rid of Saddam, but they were already complaining that the Americans were refusing to negotiate an end to the occupation and working with the Islamist political parties that had sponsored the revolt that Saddam had slaughtered the people in. You know, and later on we saw America go to war with Muqtada Sadr's movement, you know, the Shiite fundamentalist movement. Well, it just so happens that Muqtada Sadr's family is like one of the big important families that had been battling with Saddam all those years that America was supporting Saddam. I interviewed a man outside this Free Prisoners Committee who was a member of the Dawa Party, which has now come to power in the election. And, you know, Hizb al-Dawa, the Dawa Party in Arabic, it's like the party of Islamic proselytization, right? And Saddam had brutally slaughtered the Dawa Party leadership and all of the followers of the Dawa Party in 1979, 80, 81, 82, before they went into exile in Iran. And here was this guy, I was interviewing him, and he was finally finding out that his brothers had been killed during that time by Saddam's regime. And he was saying, we are so thankful that Saddam is gone, but we know that America did not free us from Saddam. It was God who freed us from Saddam. And we don't like invasion and we don't like occupation. And if the Americans have come as invaders and occupiers, then we will eventually have to fight them. And so I think that like the job of the community radio reporter is to go to as many different types of people as possible and listen. It was a big conundrum, actually, in the early occupation period, because Saddam Hussein had really put a lid on communities, you know. So it wasn't like, as a journalist working in San Francisco, there are community groups with community organizations, and if you want to cover different communities, those communities have leaders that are easily identifiable. There are independent trade unions that you can go to if you want to talk to workers. You know, there are business groups, there are, you know, environmental groups. Like, none of that was existing in Iraq because of the dictatorship. And so it was very difficult. And I was just doing the best I can. And that's actually why eventually I broke down and just decided to go door to door in economically and ethnically diverse neighborhoods and talk to as many people as I could kind of randomly. But as time would go on, you know, there came to be kind of more structure to Iraqi society. You could go talk to political parties. And you could go, as I got to know more about Iraq, you know, I would go to certain neighborhoods to make sure that I would get certain perspectives where certain communities were stronger in those neighborhoods. So I would go to Adamiya, which is a very Sunni neighborhood, which is the last place that Saddam Hussein was seen before he was found in a hole in the ground outside Tikrit. And I interviewed an auto mechanic who was part of the resistance, you know. And I would go to Mustansiriya, which is like a middle-class Sunni neighborhood, and interview people there who had been rounded up by the Americans, and go to Sadr City. And, you know, by doing this kind of work, going to different places, talking to friends of friends, you know, but making sure to have lots of different types of friends so that you have diversity in the friends that you interview. Because I don't speak Arabic well enough to work as a journalist, I had to work with translators. I tried to work with lots of different translators, even though I had like one person that I worked with most of the time. I was aware of the fact that, you know, he had his certain perspective. And so, you know, when I would go to Fallujah, I would go with somebody different. When I would go to Najaf, I would go with somebody different. I think that things kind of naturally happened over time. You know, you make relationships the more time you stay somewhere. The situation so unsafe, people are a little more circumspect. But earlier, people, you know, very, very interested in helping to get stories out. Although now, one of the reasons that I'm not going back to Iraq is it's really unsafe to be a translator working with a foreign journalist. One of the people that I worked with has fled Iraq. Another person that I've worked with is dead. And actually, when I was talking to this former colleague of mine who fled Iraq, he was telling me all the people that I know who are dead now. Most of them were killed by the resistance. But the fact remains that more people, you know, far more people have been killed by the Americans than by the resistance. I've been to Iraq 3 times. I was there immediately after the fall of Saddam Hussein for about a month. I was there for 3 months during the spring of 2004. And I was there for 2 months during this most recent elections in January and February of 2005. And I've been to enough places to see, like, in the photos, like, about dogs being put in his cell, about not being able to sleep because the Americans kept throwing pebbles at him during the night, about being kept as a 15-year-old boy in a small room, you know, by himself for days on end. I mean, but the fact that these pictures came out explicitly showing what everyone knew at the same time that the U.S. was bombing Fallujah, at the same time that the U.S. was attacking the movement of Muqtada Sadr, that was a key moment. And I think, you know, in the thesis of the book, How America Lost Iraq, is that it was then, in April of 2004, that America lost Iraq.
There is no God but God, and America is the enemy of God, hundreds of families chant at the gates of Abu Ghraib, once Saddam Hussein's most notorious prison. Now it's where the American army incarcerates people for supporting the resistance. The prison has become the center of scandal, with new photographs of severe torture released almost daily. One photo, obtained by the New Yorker magazine, shows a dead inmate wrapped in cellophane and packed in ice. Another photograph shows an empty room at the Abu Ghraib prison, splattered with blood. Standing in front of the cyclone razor wire fencing that circles the prison, Tariq explains his brother is behind bars along with his 73-year-old father. Both have been imprisoned for opposing the occupation. As under the reign of Saddam Hussein, scores of Iraqis huddle outside the gates of the prison, hoping for a chance to see their loved ones. Few of the families waiting outside Abu Ghraib have been granted a visit, and many of those with loved ones in American custody have not even been told where their family members are being held. Zahara Ibn Ali's 26-year-old son was arrested by the U.S. military a year ago in a raid that also destroyed her house. She's heard rumors that American troops killed him, but she hasn't yet given up hope.
I've been to every prison in Iraq, in Tikrit, Nasiriyah, Umm Qasr, Balad, Basra. Whenever anyone tells me a place, I will go there. I have sold everything, and I am even ready to sell my pots, because I don't have any money to go anywhere anymore. It's not a problem if they just give me the dead body of my son. If he's alive, they have to let me see him. And if he's dead, they have to bring me his body.
Who was being taken to Abu Ghraib?
Everyone. You see it this week, the news that Mohsen Abdelhamid has been arrested. Mohsen Abdelhamid is a very important Iraqi politician. He was appointed to the governing council by the U.S. military. He is widely respected by the Iraqi people. He helped negotiate an end to the first bombing of Fallujah. He's from Kirkuk in northern Iraq, where the oil is, where the Kurds and the Arabs are living side by side and possibly fighting each other. He is trying to pacify that situation. People like him, and people respect him, and he was arrested. And he was not arrested, I believe, on purpose. I believe that the Americans made a mistake. So then you have to ask yourself, if the Americans are making a mistake arresting a prominent politician, imagine how many other people they're arresting. The International Red Cross, as the Abu Ghraib prison scandal was going out of control last year in 2004, they released a report saying 90% of people arrested by the American army in Iraq are arrested by mistake. And that goes exactly with all the stories that I've heard. I interviewed an auto mechanic in Mustansuria, this, you know, middle-class neighborhood where Mustansuria University is in Baghdad, and you know, he was telling me about how he had been arrested twice by the U.S. military and taken to just the local military base there and hooded and, you know, beaten and screamed at for a few days until they realized that he wasn't the person they were looking for and they released him. I mean, almost everyone has had this kind of experience. That's the same experience that happened to Mohsen Abdelhamid this week. The U.S. military admits now that they're holding 11,000 people in Abu Ghraib. Now, a year ago, when the scandal broke, the Iraqi Minister of Human Rights, who has since resigned in protest, told me that 11,000 people were being held in Abu Ghraib, and at that time, the Pentagon was admitting to only 3,000. So if the Pentagon is now saying that there are 11,000 people there, my best guess would be it's a very conservative estimate on their part. And also, this is just one of many cases. This head of the Sadr office in Hilla, near Babylon, who was arrested at a meeting at a human rights office in April of 2004, and I've been following his case, and he is still in prison. He was finally charged after a number of months with murder by the Americans, although they haven't said who he murdered or when he murdered them. And he is no longer being held in Abu Ghraib, but he's now being held in Basra, which is even farther from his family than Abu Ghraib. This is the situation. It's just a long way from when the American soldiers used to line up with Iraqis for ice cream. Now you have a situation where if an American Humvee breaks down, they close the street. There was a situation just last week when an American tank broke down on the highway in Baghdad, the main highway going through Baghdad, and they closed the highway, the whole highway. It would be like, you know, if something broke down on I-5 coming through Portland and they just decided that nobody could go northbound on I-5 anymore. The whole freeway would be closed. That happens all the time in Iraq. I mean, there was this one time when I was trying to go meet the Minister of Human Rights, and his office was just across the Tigris River from where I was staying. The bridge, though, that connected where I was closed because that was a bridge into the Green Zone. And so that was permanently for American troops only. But then on this particular day, there had been an accident involving two American Humvees on another bridge. And after driving around in heavy traffic for 2 hours, we just gave up and went back home because we knew we wouldn't be able to make it to our meeting. I was talking to a computer scientist in Baghdad last week. He told me that he left for work at 5:30 in the morning. His work is 3 miles from his house. He arrived at 9:30 in the morning. It took him 4 hours to go 3 miles because the Americans have set up so many checkpoints in Baghdad. And I can remember going to Iraq in May of 2003. I can remember the fact that there were no checkpoints. And I was arguing with kind of like some more anti-war folks, more anti-war than me. They were saying, well, it's just like the occupation of Palestine by the Israeli military. And I would say, no, it's not. Look, I just went all the way from the Jordanian border to Baghdad, and I didn't go through one checkpoint. You know, 14 hours in a car, no checkpoints. That's not occupation. And I said, the Americans must be smart enough to know that the Iraqi people don't want to look like Palestinians on television. You know, and the moment that they perceive that their situation is similar to the Palestinians is, from what they know from watching Arab satellite television, then the U.S. military will have lost. But that's exactly what the Americans ended up doing, is exactly the way the Israelis behave in the West Bank. Being there during the elections, being in northern Iraq, but also, you know, kind of monitoring the situation in Baghdad, there was a sense that things were going to perhaps get better after the elections because people went out to vote, and for the first time in 80 years of the Iraqi state, they picked the government that they wanted, you know. And, you know, there was a boycott by most Sunnis, which is about 20%. But still, voter turnout was over 50%. It was better voter turnout than it is in the most recent presidential election between Bush and Kerry. And Ibrahim al-Jafari has become the prime minister, and he's somebody who's widely respected. He negotiated an end to the fighting in Najaf, along with Ayatollah Sistani. And Jalal Talabani, the new president, is a widely respected Kurdish leader. You know, there were problems in Kirkuk, the ethnically mixed city where a lot of the oil is. The Arabs boycotted the election because they accused the Kurds of stealing the election, and there are potential major problems in Kirkuk as the Kurds try to include that in Kurdistan. Here's the main problem, though, that's happening now. When the Shiite political parties that won the election, when they were on the campaign trail, one of their major campaign pledges was to end the occupation within 9 months to a year. People voted for them in part because they saw it as a chance to restore sovereignty. But when you have these raids and these new U.S. military operations, Operation Squeeze Play, where they've rounded up 400 people, like Operation Lightning Bolt, which they're doing now, arresting even more people in Baghdad, this bombing of Al-Qaim in the northwest of Iraq near the Syrian border, where the sheikhs who control Al-Qaim and told the Americans that there were foreign terrorists in their midst, then ended up having their whole villages being destroyed by U.S. bombers just in the last month. All of this indicates that the new Iraqi government is not going to be able to deliver on its campaign pledges. And what that means is that the government will become delegitimized and the situation will deteriorate to a situation where it's even worse than it is now. I mean, people ask me, Aaron, what if we leave? What will happen then? Will there be civil war? And I say, maybe. It's possible. It's possible that we have now screwed up Iraq so much that there will be a civil war if we leave. But the longer we stay, the more people we kill, the more people we detain and take to prison, the more crap the Iraqi people will have to sort out after we leave, and the worse it will be. And the U.S. military can take some immediate steps. They can turn control of the Iraqi army over to the Iraqi Defense Ministry, for example. But right now, the Iraqi army reports to the U.S. Army. So you have the Iraqi army affiliated with these very unpopular carpet bombings, arrest missions. You know, the Iraqi police similarly are affiliated with the occupation. Any sovereignty that can be given to this new government, I think, is a good thing, but it's not happening.
You're tuned into Circle A Radio. You've been listening to an interview with Aaron Glantz, Pacifica's free speech radio news correspondent and author of How America Lost Iraq.
I don't know what they're thinking at this point. First, they thought they were going to be able to turn it over to Ahmed Shalabi, but everyone in Iraq hated Ahmed Shalabi. Everyone knew that he had to be smuggled out of Jordan in a trunk of a car because he stole vast amounts of money from the banking system of Jordan. Everyone knew that. So then they switched to Iyad Alawi, a former CIA agent in Baathist, and everyone saw him as a puppet of the Americans, too. So finally, they went to an election. They had resisted elections. They had hired a company out of North Carolina called RTI, and their slogan was "Selections, not elections." That was their slogan. And they went in and they picked the city council in all kinds of areas in Iraq, and there were protests, mass protests, repeatedly for legitimate elections in Iraq. Some elections were organized by the movement of Muqtada Sadr. And I think that that's one of the main reasons why he was attacked by the U.S. military. And Paul Bremer said, he's a danger because he's not respecting the Iraqi government. He's building his own parallel structure. And Paul Bremer was exactly right. He was building his own parallel structure. Paul Bremer was the U.S. Administrator in Iraq until he left in the middle of the night on June 28th, 2004. So finally, after everything else failed, then they said, okay, we're going to have elections. And then what happened? These people, these Shiite religious parties that they had tried so hard to avoid putting in power, got legitimately elected by the people of Iraq, along with Kurdish leaders who have the support of the Kurdish people, which, even though the Kurds are friendly to the occupation at this time, they have their own long-term goals that are different from the U.S. military's long-term goals. And we need to let go of this idea that we should decide what happens in Iraq. The Bush administration needs to give up this notion that we can play kingmaker there. At a certain point, you know, it's their country. I mean, people are not unaware of the fact that Saddam Hussein was backed by the U.S. military for most of his rule. But they nonetheless, they wanted to get rid of him, and they were willing to be pragmatic and say, like, okay, maybe it takes America to get rid of him. But at this point, you know, they're aware of the fact that America might be trying to put in a new Saddam. That's what they saw in Alawi, a new Saddam, a former Ba'athist, a former CIA agent, maybe another Saddam. That's why the new elected Iraqi government has purged all of his people. All the people that Alawi put in have been purged by the new elected Iraqi government, which made the Bush administration very unhappy.